When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hey there, welcome to Immigrantly. I'm Sadia Khan, your host, and I am so excited to have you here in this space. Now, those of you who listen to Immigrantly regularly know that I am an anxious person. As a kid, when anxiety would rear its ugly head, I found solace in the world of stories. Creating characters and weaving narratives became my armor, my way of finding peace. And you know what? I held on to this coping mechanism until I turned 10. But now, as we see so much pain and suffering around us, I feel this burning need to create a story, once again, that soars above hatred and division. You know, when I first came to the US, I carried this hope for a better future. But today, seeing the horrors unfolding in the Middle East, my heart is heavy with despair. That's where Immigrantly comes in. It's my way of responding to this despair, a platform where stories become a powerful force for change. And I want you, all of you, to be part of it. I invite you to join me in crafting a tale that transcends borders and biases. In this story, in our story, every character embodies empathy. It's a place where understanding bridges the gap between cultures and compassion triumphs over hatred. And you know what? In today's episode, we'll do just that. I'm joined by an amazing guest, a comedian whose humor serves as a tool for change.
This is called Muslims for Peace. It's kind of crazy that we have to specify we're Muslims, but we're for peace, you know? We're Muslims. It's like not the, it's not like the default setting. It's like, we always have to qualify it. No, we're the good Muslims, you guys.
Atir Yaqub is a Palestinian Muslim comedian, writer, and podcaster based in New York. Her comedy and content revolves around personal stories of her upbringing in Alabama, immigration, religion, and gender roles. She recently came out with her debut comedy album, Denied Entry, which is available on all streaming platforms, and I highly recommend you listen to it for a good laugh.
Do we have any other Palestinians in the crowd? That's the right energy. We're exhausted from protesting. I was in Palestine this summer, and a lot of friends were messaging me, being like, oh my God, I'm seeing what's going on in the news. Is your family okay? Is your family okay? And I had to explain to them, well, actually, my family lives in Alabama. So, no.
Atir is the co-creator and co-host of Muslim Girls DTF, Discuss Their Faith, a critically acclaimed comedy sketch show, as well as co-host of the podcast The No-Fly List, where she basically engages in conversations with other minorities about their everyday experiences with humor. So let's welcome Atir to the show. Atir, Welcome to Immigrant Lietzi. I am so excited to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you live in Brooklyn. We were talking about where you live. Talk to me about Brooklyn. How do you like it?
I really love it. I'm a comedian. A lot of my friends live in the neighborhood. It's like tons of comedians. And I don't know, it's fun. I feel like it's more community. I lived in Manhattan for like 14 years and I was just ready for something new and different. And all my friends, they never leave Brooklyn. I'm like, I don't get it. And now I get it. You never want to leave. You're like, everything's around here. I don't want to go back to the city. And it's just too much. It's too stressful.
It's interesting you call it city.
I know, because people don't consider Brooklyn the city, which is kind of ridiculous, but whatever.
You know, for me, Brooklyn is city, Queens is city, Manhattan is city.
Same, I guess.
And then I live in the burbs, which is like, I would like to think I live in the city, but I don't.
City adjacent.
Yes, I like that. I like that. But you grew up somewhere else.
Yeah, so I was born in Alabama.
Initially, I thought I'll ask you, what was it like growing up in Alabama? And then I was like, no, I'm sure a lot of people have already asked this question. So I will tweak it a bit. And I'll ask you, how has growing up in Alabama informed you and your outlook on life?
Okay, I like that question already. It's given me a very grim, bleak outlook on life. So I was born there, but I moved to Palestine when I was a baby. So I lived in Palestine on and off till high school. And then I finished high school in Alabama, college, and moved to New York. So I spent a good chunk of my life in Alabama for sure. And gosh, I guess it's hard to separate like one part of your life and how it's informed your outlook, because I think that having that dichotomy more influenced my outlook in life than just living in one place. Because if you don't have it, something to compare it to, it's hard. You don't really know. It's like, I don't know. It's all I knew as a kid. I would say, it didn't really think I was different until after 9/11. And then I was like, oh, wow, then everyone, no one really knew anything about Arabs or Muslims. And then now after that, all they knew was something negative. So that was a very difficult time. And I was like, I got to get the hell out of here as quickly as possible. But my parents were like, no, you're not going out of state for college. And I was like, damn it.
So why?
Because they were strict and they were like overprotective. And
or maybe they just love you a lot and they just want you to be with them all the time.
That too. And they still do.
I'm a parent. I want my kids to be with me all the time. I'm stalking them when they're not with me.
No, I get that. They want that too. And it's just hard because, you want to live your life and you want to be happy. And I don't want to live here for the rest of my life in Alabama and continue this cycle. For me, I'm like, if they lived somewhere else, maybe, or even in Palestine, I loved living in Palestine. I didn't want to live in Alabama or the States in general. But, clearly things are not the most stable, and nor were they ever when I lived there. But still, even with that, there's community and a sense of belonging that I don't have and never, ever felt in Alabama, never felt any kind of roots being put down. It just felt like I was this foreign alien in this place and I just didn't understand. Whereas New York, like everyone feels like they belong and it's different. But then when I go to Palestine, I'm, reacquainted of
you really like, belong. Right?
Really belong.
It's so fascinating to me when I hear kids of immigrants talk about this, because I have two kids who were born here, raised here, and I see this yearning for how to belong. And for me as an immigrant, and I know you talk a lot about your parents, so I am that parent.
Yeah.
I am that immigrant parent. Since I grew up in Pakistan, I grew up in a country where I was part of the dominant population, right?
Right.
I do see myself as an outsider, insider, and I'm content with where I am. But my kids, they struggle to belong. And that really hurts me in ways. But this idea of belonging and wanting to belong is so fluid and it's so complicated for kids of immigrants. You just said that it was difficult for you to belong in Alabama. You didn't feel that you fit in. Having born here, grown up here. Why is that disconnect still?
I don't know how it would have been if I was born and raised in New York, because I do feel like I belong in New York. But it's a different psychosocial belongingness, that need for belonging from a very like innate human need to belong, that I don't have anywhere else but my homeland. And maybe because Palestine is also constantly under attack, we're told that we don't exist. And that makes us very much like, no, we do exist. We very much belong there because we're told we don't belong there. So I don't know if it's really necessarily because of my experiences in the U.S. as much as it is what's pulling me in Palestine specifically, because I have friends whose parents are from Pakistan and they don't feel like they belong there in Pakistan. But then here, I don't know. I think it's because I didn't have a community in Alabama that I felt like I belonged to. So maybe they're even like the immigrants here who were Arab or Palestinian, I feel very different because our experiences are different. So there, your experiences are just the same. You're living the same way. You're treated the same way. You speak the same language. It's different. I think it's shared experience is what makes you feel like you belong.
Let's talk about Palestine. So the last few weeks have been challenging, to say the least. A lot of things are happening in Palestine right now. Our heart goes out to people in Gaza, their suffering and their oppression. But there is a shift in consciousness in America that we are seeing. People are eager to learn about Palestine, about the history of the region, about the indigenous population, about the oppression. How do you see the current political climate and the shift that's happening? Do you think it's enough?
I'm noticing that the public opinion is shifting, but until the people in power shift their policies, I don't know how that's going to change things. But I'm hoping with the public opinion influencing and putting pressure on the powers that control all of this, we're able to make some sort of change. So we're hopeful.
Always had the best luck with men, and I think it started with my high school boyfriend. Like, I think things just didn't work out between us because I was Palestinian and he was gay.
See, you talk about Palestine, your identity, through humor.
Yeah.
You do that a lot, right? And I'm curious to know, as these conversations are shifting, conversations about Palestine are shifting, do you think humor is still the best tool for you to engage in conversations around your homeland? Or do you see that shifting too for you personally?
And that's a great question. I think in conversation, and generally, I'm not trying to be funny and making jokes because I'm like, I do that for a living. I'm not going to do that in conversations unless it organically comes up. But humor was and it still is the tool for me to express myself. And the fact that our voices are being suppressed and people are getting, you know, fired for talking about their beliefs and for speaking out against these atrocities. You know, I'm sure there's places that don't want to book me. Social media is literally taking down posts and silencing and shadow banning and blocking, you know, Palestinians from speaking out. So I feel an even greater duty to do this through humor because, like, I enjoy doing satire, political humor, because that's how I started this experience, like, shaped me and who I am. So for me, my comedy is very personal and talking about my life. And so how can it not be informed by this experience that really made me who I am? So I continue to use it and I'm still talking about it on stage and I'm going up and making jokes to bring attention to the situation. I did like a little satire sketch on my Instagram that was well received just to show the hypocrisy and kind of what's going on. So I think when people take things in through humor, definitely they're guard is down. So they're able to take in messaging that maybe otherwise they wouldn't have, because you're not as guarded if you're laughing. And then you might not even realize fully why you're laughing. And then it kind of seeps in and you're like, oh.
Yeah, it's more palatable.
Yeah.
You also talk about how important it is for you that your humor be relatable.
Yeah.
How do you define relatability?
I think a lot of it is universal stuff, just talking about family and dating and, you know, those dynamics that we have between relationships. Like, everyone can relate to that, because when we relate to something, it makes us care about it.
Hmm.
And we have a shared experience and a shared bond.
Right. See, this is something that I've asked other comedians too. A lot of times you talk about stuff in a self-deprecating way, right? You're making fun of yourself or culture, parents. And I wonder, how do you ensure that your comedy doesn't reinforce the stereotypes that already exist, especially in the US, around immigrants or accents, culture, and norms?
Well, I try not to make jokes that do reinforce the stereotype. And if I do, I hope people understand that it's supposed to be ironic and satirical, putting up a mirror or a light to those things that have been said about us and just showing how ridiculous they are.
Give me an example of the ridiculousness of things that people say about, you know, Arabs or Muslims, Palestinians.
Yeah, I mean, you know, especially in the South, like constantly being asked, like, what church do you go to? What are you? Kind of alluding to the fact, obviously, that we're terrorists, because that's like their like go-to thing, saying that we're backwards. And then I'll, you know, try to make a joke that shows that they're actually the ones that are backwards and kind of a shine a light to that. You know, I have a joke about my brother being a progressive Muslim husband and father.
My older brother, he's married with kids, and my brother is actually a pretty progressive Arab Muslim husband, because he cooks, he cleans, he takes care of the kids, he wears the hijab in the family.
Like something silly like that, where it's like just sort of challenging the gender roles that they think that we have.
Talking about humor and stereotypes, I was listening to one of your segments in your album, Denied Entry, and you talk about your name, Atir. What does it mean, by the way, before I even ask you this question?
So it's not the same root word, I don't think, from my research, but it does have like an ethereal meaning, something in the atmosphere. Also means like something valuable, but it's something like celestial.
You talk about how people are confused about your ethnicity because your name sounds weird to them. And then they will come up with all these different ways to, you know, gauge who you are and say weird stuff. Can you share a few anecdotes of how people have guessed who you are because of your name?
People just don't know what to ask. Like, I mean, in the South or in Alabama, people are shameless and just will say, what are you? What is this? But
is it different in New York?
Yeah, no one cares in New York, which is so refreshing. No one gives a shit. People just say, oh, that's a cool name. What's the origin of that name? And that's fine. But people aren't like, what is that? What are you?
Yeah, that's acceptable.
Yeah, that's acceptable. They're just curious. And they're like, that's a really nice name. What's the origin? But yeah, it's crazy with other. I had a joke about like this woman was like, you look international.
Oh,
like just
wow.
Trying to, I'm like, it's very creative way to be like, so what is that?
You know, because I have an accent, people are quick to judge. The minute I open my mouth, they know I'm not originally from the United States. And I used to work for the small civil society organization. We used to do a lot of work with UN women and UN entities. And I remember I was sitting in a meeting at the UN, and there was this sweet lady sitting next to me, and she goes to me, where are you from? And my response was, okay, I'm not going to tell her where I am from. I'm just going to tell her what town I'm from in New York. And I was like, oh, I'm from this town. And obviously that wasn't enough for her. So she pauses for a minute and then she turns around again. And she's like, but where is this beautiful accent from? And then I was like, yeah, this accent is from Pakistan, but Pakistan doesn't have one accent. So I honestly don't really get the question, but I know what she was saying.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how sometimes we think there are spaces that are more inclusive, progressive, whatever you call them, but they are not actually as progressive or inclusive as you would want them to be. Adi, talk to me about your podcast, The No Fly List.
Yeah, so it's in hibernation now, but I had a podcast called The No Fly List where we interviewed other comedians, artists, and musicians, whoever, like POC, and talking about their experiences growing up brown, black, Latino in America.
Hi guys, I'm Athir.
And I'm Layla.
And we're on the No Fly List.
What?
No, our podcast, The No Fly List.
Oh, right. Sorry. I just got back from Guantanamo. I've got Gitmo brain.
Gitmo brain. Oh, no. Seriously, Layla is a journalist reporting from Guantanamo.
And Athir is a comedian and writer who hasn't been sent to Guantanamo yet, but who knows?
That's right. Every episode, we're going to bring you fun and interesting guests as we talk about the joys of being
brown. You have this segment where you put people on the no-fly list.
Oh, yeah. So people that we don't like. I mean, if we still had it.
We'll do it here on Immigrantly.
I was going to say.
So let's put a few people on the no-fly list right now.
Actual people who don't deserve to fly instead of innocent people like us. I mean, where do we begin? Biden, the whole administration, all of America. I mean, the government, not the people, because apparently a lot of the people are actually shifting their opinion. The whole Israeli cabinet. Let's just say Zionists. Okay, period. That covers a lot of people.
But there are so many nice, sweet people out there, right?
Absolutely.
Growing up, I remember my dad would always talk about how Muslims are so similar to Jews. And we do find humanity in communities because it's not about religion or religious identity. It's about politics and oppression and colonialism.
And it's interesting because every time we post something about Palestine, we have to be like, but we're not anti-Jewish. We're not anti-Semitic. Anti-Zionism isn't anti-Semitism. And, you know, it made me realize, and a lot of people have been talking about this, like now we are centering our suffering around this narrative that they try to feed into the world, that if you criticize Israel, if you criticize Zionism, which is inherently a fascist, racist ideology. So if you're like, are you against fascism? Are you against racism? Are you against treating other people as lesser than human? Then you also hate Zionism. But then those same people, there's such a cognitive dissonance. Lately, it's crazy how like you sort of want to preempt it like, no, like we have nothing against our Jewish community. And like, actually, they've been huge allies to us. And like Jewish Voice for Peace have been incredible. And so I want to stop making that the next logical leap that just because you say you're anti-Zionist, you have to follow it up with, but we also love Jewish people. Yeah, it's a given. Like it should be a given. Mm. And it's like, it sucks that the burden is on us to have to say that constantly.
You're absolutely right. But that narrative was set post 9/11. We've been carrying that burden for more than 20 years. Anytime anything happens or if there is an attack by Muslim perpetrators, every Muslim in the entire world has to justify their existence and they have to say, oh, by the way, we denounce this act of terrorism wherever it's happening. You're absolutely right. That narrative has to shift because it is taxing. It is also burdensome on Muslims and their mental health and their well-being. But at the same time, as you said, there is so much propaganda around, oh, Muslims are saying this because they don't like Jewish community. I feel it's also important to be vocal about that when you feel comfortable being vocal, right? So for me, saying this, and it may be because I am not as closely attached as you are, right? Because Palestine and Palestinian cause is extremely personal to you. There is no way that I could ever understand what you go through and how you feel. For me, it's also important to say that, but you're right. We cannot say it again and again because we are tired too.
We're not responsible.
And we are not responsible for somebody else's actions. I was thinking about this. Are people asking white Christians about the atrocities that Christians committed or white supremacists continue to commit? How many times do people say, oh, do you denounce this?
Right.
Have you denounced it?
Yeah.
How many times do people ask any other religious identity about the atrocities that people from their community have committed? And by the way, every human being, every religious ethnic group at some point may have committed some atrocities.
Of course.
So you're right. It is taxing. The last few weeks have been exhausting. As a Muslim, they have been exhausting. And I can't imagine what you must be going through. But just as someone who identifies as Muslim, I am an anxious person to begin with, and my anxiety is at I don't know where, right? And that is because I know that we have to prove our innocence. We are assumed guilty first.
Yes. And the demonization of Muslims has been happening for ages. The struggle for Palestinian freedom also, you know, while there is a huge Muslim majority in Palestine, there's also a huge Christian population that are also treated the same as Muslims because they're Palestinian. And the ideology of the state of Israel is to have an exclusively Jewish state and only give rights to their Jewish members, white Jewish members, because Ethiopian Jews, Yemeni Jews, others, they are treated lesser than. Also now, if you're anti-Zionist, even if you're Orthodox or Hasidic, they're also subject to beatings. There's like footage now of protesters, anti-Zionist protesters in Israel, their own citizens, are now getting beaten. So now it has become clear the distinction between what they want. They don't even want just an exclusively Jewish state. It's now a Zionist fascist regime. And anyone that doesn't comply is subject to physical, mental harm, being expelled. Now they've shifted so far, right, that even their own citizens are like up in arms.
Yeah. How difficult can it be to see humanity in everyone and to see everybody's self-worth and dignity? Like, how difficult can that be? Why are some humans treated lesser? And I will say this, this is something that we've seen in the West. And every time, especially for Muslims, obviously specifically for Palestinians, it's like every time we're like, okay, now everything is fine. We belong. We're happy. Things are moving forward. And then something happens and it just takes us like at least, I don't know, 30 years back, that regression of how Muslims are viewed. And it's tiring.
Yeah. My theory also, I have this book about the sociopaths, world leaders, and CEOs. So it's talking about how most of these people are sociopaths. It's not the same as like being a killer or, but some of them are. And so in order to be in these places of power, in order to be someone that wants to attain this level of power, you must be sick in the head in some way. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think when you say empathy, sociopaths lack empathy. So I do see other countries that have experienced oppression and a history similar to ours stand up because they can see that and they can empathize.
But do you think there is lack of knowledge as well?
If we're talking about people, it's a lot of brainwashing.
Brainwashing or lack of knowledge. Sometimes we don't have enough knowledge or we don't want to talk about stuff that makes us uncomfortable, right? It's difficult.
Or like, anything that challenges the narrative that you've been told since, because it shakes you, because
shakes
a lot of people are coming out from underneath that Zionist brainwashing and talking about how they were taught at a very young age since Hebrew schools, this completely different narrative and not even bringing up Palestinians to the story as if we weren't there. And that's the story. So I think it challenges their identity, their sense of self. And so when you deconstruct that, this one belief that you've been told to hold on to for dear life, and now you realize that it was a lie, a very elaborate, disgusting, violent lie, it makes you question your whole self because you're like, well, if this isn't true, what else is not true? So it makes sense. It's easier to not open that door and pull at that thread when it comes to anything that challenges your identity.
Exactly. Like, I feel like growing up in Pakistan, there is a history, right? A bloody history of partition. There's a bloody history of 1971 war. And we were fed a narrative. We grew up with that narrative. We really believed in that narrative. And when I came to the US, and even now, when we look back and I think about partition and even 1971 war, where Bangladesh was created and the atrocities that were committed by Pakistani army at the time, it's difficult to digest all of that, right? Because in my mind, there are some institutions that are sacrosanct. To challenge yourself is the most difficult thing. To challenge your pre-existing notions and narratives about what you really believe in, and you almost hold on to that as part and extension of your identity. But we all have to do it for our collective humanity. Because if we don't, then how do we call ourselves human at the end of the day? Athir, let's talk about comedy now.
I thought we were. Is that not hilarious?
So I interviewed Aiza Fatima.
Yes, she's my creative partner.
She is wonderful. And
yes, she's incredible.
And again, you guys use humor to talk about a lot of issues, and you talk about dating.
Yeah.
Let's go to dating. From you know, war and destruction, we are moving to dating, guys.
It's the same thing.
It's the same thing.
Look, it also has a lot of destruction.
It has a lot of destruction. I've been married for, 20 years?
Wow.
That was the last time I dated, and that too was my husband, so I don't know if that counts. Talk to me about your experience in the dating world. And I know you guys do this comedy called
Muslim Girls
DTF.
Discuss their faith.
You've talked about Islamophobia.
Yeah.
Through dating.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure you have some interesting stories to share with us. So talk to me about that.
So it's a talking heads and a sketch comedy show, and we're now doing a live stand-up show as well. But we bring on, different Muslim women of different backgrounds and talk about what it's like dating as a Muslim woman, or what's it like, if you date someone who is ignorant to the religion, and what kind of questions that people ask you, how they hit on you. And
what kind of questions people ask?
Well, it's funny when they someone's hitting on you and they try to just learn a couple of words of Arabic, or be salam alaikum, or just something like
that. Does it bother you when people say salam alaikum who
don't know? I mean, if you're just doing it with the purpose of getting into my pants, yes. But if you're just saying it I see you, and I'm just saying peace, then yes. And if you know what it means, then sure.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
If you're just making a mockery out of it.
You're right.
I've mostly dated Palestinian men, and I was engaged to one, a Palestinian Muslim. Then I realized this was the narrative I had to deconstruct. Mm. I must be with someone Muslim, and I must be with someone, if not Palestinian, definitely Arab. Ideally Muslim, Palestinian, Arab, but if you have one of those things, great.
It's okay.
Yeah. After my engagement totally blew up in my face and didn't work out, I realized I was just setting this standard that I've been told I must comply to, because everyone in my family did. All my brothers married traditional Palestinian women and doing the thing, have the kids and get married. And I'm the only one out of three boys. And now my younger brother got married. So it's what's wrong with her?
Yep.
So I had to open up my worldview about that and be maybe I don't have to. And there are other people I can relate to with similar experiences.
What was the most challenging part of getting to that point where you're maybe I don't have to?
I think it took a few years. It takes meeting different people and opening up your world to them, and realizing, okay, this could work. I could, possibly bring this person in my family. But at the end of the day, you're going to be living with that person and your family will come around. I met other people who've married out of their faith or ethnic background, culture. But the more I talk to people from different cultures, children of immigrants, we all have the same experiences. It's very easy to relate.
It goes back to self-preservation, right? Yeah. A lot of parents just want to preserve their culture, their identity through their kids, which sometimes can be obviously difficult for their kids to reconcile with. So are you dating right now?
Yeah, I've been with someone for 2 years. He's Haitian, and so his parents are immigrants. And so we relate very much on this topic. And I haven't introduced him to the parents yet.
You haven't?
I told my mom, once you meet the parents, it's we're getting married, right? You don't just be oh, this is my boyfriend. There's no word for, you're just you're engaged.
He hasn't met your parents yet?
No, my mom knows about him, but I'm last step will be
but that's a good thing. She knows about him.
Yeah,
right?
She knows. I told her. She never brings it up. I think she pretends she never heard it, but I'm okay, well, we're gonna have to
have this conversation
about, again. So, but I'm sure they'll love him once they meet him. And honestly, it took meeting him to completely deprogram that last bit of I have to be with someone that is X. What about your values? I was willing to compromise myself to be with somebody that my parents, who don't know me at all.
Oh my gosh, this scares me.
Because I think
about my kids and I'm do they think I don't know them?
Do your parents know you fully?
Yeah, you're right. But we change. We change, right? So I think my parents probably know me when I was in my 20s. They know that version of me. And I've changed so much. Now I'm in my 40s and I've changed so much, right? But you're right. As a kid, I get it. As a parent, it almost freaks me out.
Yeah.
And I always tell my daughters, you know, I'm always here for you. You can come to me always. And I'm pretty sure they don't come to me for everything, which is fine.
Then you've raised them right to be self-reliant, and that's a good thing.
Nobody in Alabama knew where Palestine was or what it was. So my mom would tell me, oh, just tell them you're from where Jesus is from. And they're like, oh, Texas.
So why denied entry? How did this come about? I like that you have this recurring through line, right? The no-fly list and now denied entry.
Because we're being pushed out. We're being denied existence, denied entry. I'm Palestinian from the West Bank. I'm also landlocked, can't go anywhere. You know, when I go there, even though I was born in the U.S., I go there, I'm stripped completely of any American rights that I have, and I'm treated like a Palestinian. So I cannot go anywhere, cannot go into Israel. I'm denied entry, cannot use their airport. I have to go through Jordan, cross the border, and go through all that. Not even through the American side of the border. I have to go through the Palestinian side. And it's fucked up because any Jewish person around the world can go there now and have more rights to that land than I do, or my parents do, who were born there. Prior to 1948, prior to the existence of Israel, my dad was born in 43. He's still alive. So imagine being born in a country that people come, settle in, colonize, genocide your people, and they're like, now you don't belong here, and you can't come here.
On by Israeli men. Like, I was at a party and this Israeli guy was there and he found out I was Palestinian. He got like really turned on about it and he was hitting on me and trying to get into my pants the whole night, but I turned him down. I had to, because I wanted him to know what it feels like to be denied entry.
So these are small segments, like 1 minute, 3 minutes. Why did you choose that structure?
I don't know if I chose that structure intentionally. Since I started doing comedy, that short form, it might be like the ADD person in me that's like, I can only stick to short form. And whenever I tell a story, it's just like long-winded and all over the place. But I do want to actually get to more storytelling. But I think because my jokes are like very much about the writing and it's usually like short form jokes, and I like kind of like the word play, and I just really fixate on certain words rather than like the storytelling aspect. But I would like to incorporate more longer form storytelling. And I'm trying to be now a little bit more like loose and off the cuff and just tell a story as it is.
Between comedy and writing, do you have a preference?
Definitely doing stand-up and stand-up writing, but I also write scripts and stuff and trying to work on more of the narrative piece, because that's cool too. It's just a different skill. And then the beauty of stand-up is you can write something that day, go up, say it, and see how it does. Okay, is it funny? Is it not? Of course, you have to give it multiple chances. But with a script, you know, I could spend hours and weeks writing something and I'm like, I have no idea if this is total garbage or people, like, there's no immediate feedback. And comedy is the only art form where you're getting immediate feedback.
Whether, like, your joke landed or not. Have there been instances, Atir, where it didn't? And how did you turn it around, or what did you do?
Oh, all the time. I mean, you know, you gotta throw a bunch of things at the wall and see what sticks and just like shoot your shot as much as you can. And sometimes it's just because it's new, the joke will evolve. Like, you go back, you analyze, and like you restructure and you keep pruning away and try. And I think that's the beauty of it, is that it's not just one shot and you're done. You get to continually evolve the joke and work on it. So I like that aspect of it a lot.
Do you have any favorite comedians?
I mean, obviously Chappelle, even though he said some crazy shit, although
he has said some crazy shit. But you're right, he's funny.
I like David Cross because he has like a political humor, and he grew up Jewish in maybe Atlanta or Georgia. And so I relate to him a lot. He's one of the funniest people. I relate to him a lot as someone who grew up in the South as non-Christian. And so I've been listening to him and watching him for ages. I like Fortune Feimster. She also grew up in the South. I like Tig Notaro because she's very like deadpan. But there's so many amazing comedians like locally too, and like friends and people that I just genuinely enjoy that are not household names yet, but they will be.
You've mentioned South so many times, and as a Muslim woman, I'm almost scared to go to Alabama or Tennessee. Again, going back to narratives that we have fed. Now, I don't know how true that is and should I be scared or not. I feel like going anywhere outside New York seems like a chore to me right now.
You know, also depends. If you go to Birmingham, it's a big metropolitan city. No one's going to, like,
it's not that
you.
Big, though. It's what, like 200,000 people or something?
compared to the small towns in Alabama.
You're right.
They're like politely racist.
What is polite racism? Talk to me about that. I want to know.
They're just like, what are you? Like, do you live in a sand dune? Do you get by donkey?
That would be
offensive,
so offensive.
But they don't realize they're being offensive. They'll also be polite to your face, but hate you as a person. Or hate Muslims, not maybe you specifically, but because you're Muslim. So, but they'll still be nice to you, which I'm like, at least in New York, people are like to your face.
To your face.
Even my building manager, he's like this really hardcore Israeli guy, like served in the army, the whole thing. And he keeps calling me Miss Yaakov, which is a Hebrew version of my last name, Yaakov. So I'm pretty sure that he thinks that I'm Jewish or Israeli. And it's kind of awkward because I don't want to come out and tell him that I'm actually Palestinian. Because, like, what if I come home one day and find him living in my apartment?
At the in the end, if you were to describe the United States of America in a word or a sentence, I know. How would you do that?
The government, the people?
I'll let you pick.
I mean, I think the government is fascist. The people are, it depends where. Like, I think people in the South who are racist are ignorant. I think
you really believe that?
Yeah, it's a lot of ignorance. And most people are not critical thinkers. Most people in general, so they will believe whatever they're told without fact checking, without doing the reading. Because, you know, I wish people, you know, were like, don't believe us. Don't even read a book. Please go to Palestine and see for yourself. But if you go there and you go through the Israeli airport and you tell them you're going to the West Bank, they'll tell you not to go. It's for your own safety. Don't do it. But if you just say, oh, you're there for tourism, and then you go to the West Bank, they don't want you to see the atrocities that they're committing. They don't want you to see for your own eyes. And so if you go and see it for yourself, I mean, please, by all means, like, don't believe me. Just go see for your own self. So it's ignorance in a lot of ways why people feel the way they feel.
If there is anything or any book that really resonates with you that you would recommend.
One of the first books that comes to mind is, I think it's Rashid Khalidi, 100 Year War on Palestine.
I'm reading that.
Yeah. And then there was one by an Israeli author called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine.
At the end of the day, it's more about learning the facts and the history and the context, which I think we should all do, irrespective of what we believe in or how we approach this issue and how invested or not invested we are in this, right?
Yeah. And it's not complicated. They keep saying that so that it deters people from reading for themselves. But even if you've never read anything, people who consider themselves liberals, you know, they'll be like, yeah, Black Lives Matter. They'll be for the Native Americans. Let's do land acknowledgement. But these people are all like also standing up with us, the Global South, and anyone who's been oppressed and been subjugated to these same conditions, like, understand. But they see it from our perspective. Do you not see like the same thing, like segregation, South Africa, apartheid, like, this has happened over and over and over. This is a cycle of colonialism, a cycle of abuse. It's not anything new. It's nothing new. They didn't reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, but that's what I was going to say. Look, I feel America first has to reconcile with its own history of Native American genocide. America is not prepped to understand the nuance or to think critically because of lack of information about its own history. And a lot of times, people like us who come from all these different countries, we've in some shape or form been part of some conflict. I grew up in the 80s and 90s in Pakistan, and the spillover from Soviet invasion of Afghanistan was a reality for us. My mother would not take us to the bazaar or anywhere because she thought there would be a bomb blast and we would die. We were living in Peshawar at the time. So I think maybe start there and see how do we reconcile with the US history. And then I think it will become easier for people to see oppression and colonialism in other parts of the world. Because if you are yourself settlers, how do you reconcile with somebody else's history? Anyways, it's you. Thank you for coming on Immigrantly, for speaking your mind. I am so grateful. And hopefully people can find your comedy, Denied Entry, on Spotify. Where else can people find you?
If you just follow me on Instagram, it's just my full name, @AthirYakub, then you'll see links to shows and anything else coming up. A lot of Palestine stuff, so also if you want to learn about that, go to my page. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You know, Athir is right. I am sick and tired of justifying my humanity or to make other people comfortable around my thoughts. Our goal through this podcast is to recognize the humanity in everyone. It's a platform for safe conversations about people who are marginalized, who are oppressed, who don't get platforms to talk about as much. I know this conversation may not resonate with some. It may make others angry. It may be an uncomfortable, inconvenient truth. But I really encourage everybody to pause, think about it, ruminate, read, explore. Be curious about history. What makes us strong as humans is curiosity. What makes us strong as humans is empathy and humanity, collective humanity, above everything else. This episode was produced by me, written by Pippa Suki Carlson and me. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer for this episode is Paroma Chakravarti. Immigrantly's theme music is by Simon Hutchinson. Until next time, take care, be kind to yourself and to others.